Elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the Ark of the Lord's Covenant from Zion, the city of David. All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon at the time of the festival in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month. When all the elders of Israel had arrived, the priests took up the Ark, and they brought up the Ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the sacred furnishings in it. The priests and Levites carried them up, and King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that had gathered about him were before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and cattle that they could not be recorded or counted. The priests then brought the ark of the Lord's covenant to its place in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, and put it beneath the wings of the cherubim. The cherubim spread their wings over the place of the ark and overshadowed the ark and its carrying poles. These poles were so long that their ends could be seen from the holy place in front of the inner sanctuary, but not from outside the holy place, and they are still there today. There was nothing in the ark except two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. When the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever." While the whole assembly of Israel was standing there, the king turned round and blessed them, and then he said, "Praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his own hand has fulfilled what he promised with his own mouth to my father David. For he said, 'Since the day I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I have not chosen a city in any tribe of Israel to have a temple built for my name to be there, but I have chosen David to rule my people Israel.' My father David had it in his heart to build a temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, 'Because it was in your heart to build a temple for my name, you did well to have this in your heart. Nevertheless, you are not the one to build the temple, but your son, who is your own flesh and blood, he is the one who will build the temple for my name. The Lord has kept the promise he made. I have succeeded David, my father, and now I sit on the throne of Israel, just as the Lord promised, and I have built the temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. I have provided a place there for the ark, in which is the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of Egypt.'"
I wonder if you're a dog person or a cat person. We know the Passmores are definitely dog people. Maybe not every day, most days. I'm more of a dog person as well than a cat person. But our family pet is a cat, Houdini. Now, other than being a cat, I'm actually quite fond of him. Except when he decides to act like a cat. Like he's always sitting where he shouldn't. That's on the couch cushions, on the washing, up against the low-hanging curtains, on the flowers. He knows he shouldn't because when I come downstairs, I can hear him scrambling to get to a safe place. If I don't hear him, he kind of sneaks past me looking very guilty as I come into the room. So what we did is we bought him a comfortable cat basket. And so now, Houdini sleeps on the couch cushions, on the washing, up against the low-hanging curtains, on the flowers. See, the basket is for him, and I bet he even knows it's for him, but he won't sleep in it. He's not interested. It's for him, but he won't use it. And in chapter 8, the first part of our question, the first part of chapter 8 is this. There's a question. This magnificent temple is built for God. But will he dwell in it? Will he dwell among his people? Will his presence be among his people? And so far in 1 Kings, we've seen that the kingdom has passed from King David to his son Solomon. In chapters 1 and 2, we see that it is God who has established Solomon on the throne. In chapter 2, verses 2 to 4, we have David's charge to Solomon. It would be good to read that. Chapter 2, verses 2 and 4, just back a few pages. David says these words to Solomon on his deathbed. "I am about to go the way of all the earth," being a bit dramatic possibly, he said, "so be strong, show yourself a man, and observe what the Lord your God requires. Walk in his ways and keep his decrees and commands, his laws and requirements as written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all you do and wherever you go, and that the Lord may keep his promise to me. If your descendants watch how they live, and if they walk faithfully before me with all their heart and soul, you will never fail to have a man on the throne of Israel." And these are the words by which we must judge every single king after David. Will they observe what the Lord requires? Will Solomon observe what the Lord requires? Then in chapter 3, Solomon asks God for wisdom. God is pleased with his request and gives him wisdom and fame and fortune. In chapters 4 and 5, we see evidence of Solomon's great wisdom. Last week, we looked at the detail in chapter 6 and 7, where Solomon builds the temple for God, an impressive home for God, but we also see that he builds himself a more impressive home for himself. In chapter 6, verse 12, God speaks these words to Solomon, a reminder of what David said to Solomon. Chapter 6, verse 12. "As for the temple you are building, if you follow my decrees, carry out my regulations, and keep all my commands and obey them, I will fulfill through you the promise I gave to David your father, and I will live among the Israelites and will not abandon my people Israel." So the temple's good, obedience to God's laws and decrees is better. It's also the language of God's promises. "Keep my commands, I'll keep my promises, you'll be blessed." And in this chapter, the blessing here is that God is going to live among his people. "Keep my commands, and we will share the same postcode. Keep my commands, and heaven will touch earth." Solomon is mostly on track with sticking to his father's words, as we've seen, and following God's commands. But we have seen some hints of cracks. There are cracks beginning to show in the way King Solomon follows the Lord. At the start of chapter 6, we're reminded that the temple building project was the most significant thing to happen to Israel since God rescued them from Egypt. The temple is built, but the question is, will God live in the temple? Will God live among his people? And so we come to 1 Kings chapter 8. And it starts in verse 1 and 2 by telling us that all this takes place during the festival. Verse 1. "Then King Solomon summoned into his presence at Jerusalem the elders of Israel, all the heads of the tribes and the chiefs of the Israelite families, to bring up the ark of the Lord's covenant from Zion, the city of David. All the men of Israel came together to King Solomon at the time of the festival, in the month of Ethanim, the seventh month." So Solomon gathers together all the Israelite leaders to bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from where it was being kept in Jerusalem to the temple. The ark, or the Lord's covenant, is the special box that contained the two stone tablets of the Ten Commandments given to Moses by God. And the ark symbolized God's presence, leading the way as God led his people to the promised land. An ark just simply means box. If you remember from chapter 7, the temple was finished in the eighth month. But here verse 2 tells us that the ark was brought up in the seventh month. We're not sure what year it is exactly, but I think what makes the most sense here is that Solomon waited till the following year to bring the ark into the temple to coincide it with the celebration of the Feast of Tabernacles. And that's quite significant, actually. We know that it was the Feast of Tabernacles that was being spoken about at the end of verse 2, because the Tabernacle Feast was a week-long celebration that took place in the seventh month, as verse 65 tells us. Verse 65 tells us that it was meant to be a week-long celebration, but the party was so big that they went on for another week. Keep your place in 1 Kings and turn quickly to Leviticus chapter 23. It's on page 89 in the Blue Church Bibles. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 33. Leviticus 23, the Lord said to Moses, "Say to the Israelites, on the 15th day of the 7th month of the Lord's Feast of Tabernacles begins, and it lasts for 7 days. The first day is a sacred assembly. Do no regular work. For 7 days present offerings made to the Lord by fire, and on the 8th day hold a sacred assembly and present an offering made to the Lord by fire. It is the closing assembly. Do no regular work." Then we have a bunch of further directions for how they were to celebrate. Skip down to verse 42. Live in booths, that's tents, for 7 days. All native-born Israelites are to live in booths, so that your descendants will know that I made the Israelites live in booths when I brought them out of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. So it's significant that the ark is coming to the temple during the Feast of Tabernacles, because it's signifying that the journey is over. God's people are in the land. Israel's nomadic, wandering, living in tents is over. The Feast of Tabernacles reminded Israel of their journey to the Promised Land. That journey is now over. The ark is coming to its final destination. The baton, so to speak, has been passed on from the temporary tabernacle to the permanent temple. In verses 3 to 5, the ark comes up to the temple. Along with the ark comes the tabernacle and all its furnishings. According to God's law, only the Levites were allowed to handle the ark and its furnishings. We see that Solomon obeys that law. It will come up on the screen, so we don't need to turn there. Numbers chapter 3, verse 31. Speaking about a family within the tribe of Levite, they were responsible for the care of the ark. The table, the lampstand, the altars, the articles of the sanctuary used in ministering, the curtain, and everything related to their use. The chief leader of the Levites was Eleazar, son of Aaron, the priest. He was appointed over those who were responsible for the care of the sanctuary. So the ark with the tabernacle and all its furnishings are being brought up to the temple. And it's done in a way that mimics David, when David brought the ark to Jerusalem in the first place. You can read about that in 2 Samuel chapter 6, where there's a massive celebration and many sacrifices as the people celebrated God's presence, God's ark, coming into Jerusalem. Take a look at verse 3, chapter 8 of 1 Kings. When all the elders of Israel had arrived, the priests took up the ark, and they brought up the ark of the Lord and the tent of meeting and all the sacred furnishings in it. The priests and Levites carried them up, and King Solomon and the entire assembly of Israel that had gathered about him were before the ark, sacrificing so many sheep and cattle that they could not be recorded or counted. The ark coming up into the temple is a big deal. It's a huge celebration. The biblical authors and their contemporaries were really, really good at counting things and keeping record of things. We have that countless times in the Bible where they count and list everybody who's involved, all the people, all the objects, all through the Bible we're given numerical details. Because somebody bothered to count and record numbers of people and possessions. But not here. Yeah, we can imagine somebody starting to count and then just giving up. It's just too many to be recorded or counted. It's a big deal, the ark coming to the temple. We're going to go past verses 6 to 8. And just note that the ark is placed in the inner sanctuary of the temple, the most holy place, the Holy of Holies. And then verse 9 to 13 answers our question. Will God dwell among his people? Follow with me from verse 9. There was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. When the priests withdrew from the holy place, the cloud filled the temple of the Lord, and the priests could not perform their service because of the cloud, for the glory of the Lord filled his temple. Then Solomon said, "The Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. Here's our first point. God's presence fills the temple according to his covenant. God will dwell among his people. And the rest of the chapter is filled with this language of the covenant. The covenant is the agreement God made with Israel. We see it in its most basic terms in Exodus 19. It'll come up on the screen as well. You yourselves have seen what I did to Egypt, and how I carried you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now if you obey me fully and keep my covenant, then out of all nations you will be my treasured possession. Although the whole earth is mine, you will be for me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. You see, God is the one who rescued Israel. They must obey him fully. They will be his people. And God's presence fills the temple according to his covenant. And we see this link to the covenant in verse 9. There was nothing in the ark except the two stone tablets that Moses had placed in it at Horeb, where the Lord made a covenant with the Israelites after they came out of Egypt. The stone tablets referred to the Ten Commandments, the primary commands of the covenant that Israel were to obey. Moses is the one who received the covenant and the stone tablets. God is the one who brought them up out of Egypt. You see, Horeb was the start of the covenant. The events here fulfill it. Solomon says as much in verse 15 as he addresses Israel. And I love this verse. I love the image that it has in verse 15. Solomon says, praise be to the Lord, the God of Israel, who with his own hand has fulfilled what he promised with his own mouth to my father David. You see, what God's mouth promises, his hands do. God does what God says. God keeps his covenant. God keeps his promises. Verse 20. The Lord has kept the promise he made. I have succeeded David, my father. And now I sit on the throne of Israel, just as the Lord promised. And I have built the temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. I have provided a place for the ark, in which the covenant of the Lord that he made with our fathers when he brought them out of Egypt. What God's mouth promises, his hands do. As soon as the priests place the ark in the holy place, God's cloud fills the temple. And we're told that the priests couldn't return because of God's glory filling the temple. We know, don't we, where there's smoke, there's fire. Smoke equals fire. The Israelites knew that where there's cloud in this way, there's God. They knew that God was present in the cloud because cloud, in this context, equals God. In Exodus 13, God leads Israel out of Egypt with a pillar of cloud. And from a pillar of cloud and fire, he defends Israel as he throws the Egyptian army into confusion. Then in Exodus 19 and 24, God meets Moses on Mount Horeb in a thick cloud with thunder and lightning. And in Exodus 33, we're told, as Moses went into the tent of meeting, a pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord spoke with Moses. Solomon reminds the people in verse 12 that God is in the cloud. Verse 12, then Solomon said, the Lord has said that he would dwell in a dark cloud. I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. The cloud in the temple shows that God is present, dwelling in the temple just as he said he would. Now, I hope this is correct. I Googled it, and hopefully it's right. But it's much the same way that when the royal standard flies over Buckingham Palace, Windsor Castle, or Sandringham House, it shows that the Queen is present. Like the royal standard, the cloud shows that God is present in his temple. God's presence fills the temple according to the covenant. But he is not limited to the temple. And that leads to our second point. God is not contained by the temple. It's really hard to believe, but 26 years ago, Walt Disney released the movie Aladdin. And in it, the genie, who is voiced by Robin Williams, laments the problem of being a genie. He says, it's all part of the genie gig. Phenomenal cosmic power. Itty bitty living space. And in the story, the genie has all this power, but he's confined to living in a lamp. While this is true for fictional genies, this is not true about the God of the Bible. God's power is seen in his glory as his cloud fills the temple. He is so powerful, he is so glorious that no one can stand in the presence of him. He is the one that makes huge promises and keeps them all. And Solomon for now is a good guy, but he doesn't seem to get it right here. He says in verse 13, I have indeed built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. Solomon says, I've built you a temple to dwell in. How totally ridiculous is this? I've built something for God to live in. You will dwell in it. Well, sorry, Solomon. God is way bigger than that. God is not physically going to dwell and be limited to this temple. In verses 16 to 19, Solomon quotes God's words to Israel. See what God says will dwell in the temple. For he said, since the day I brought my people Israel out of Egypt, I have not chosen a city in any tribe of Israel to have a temple built so that my name might be there. But I have chosen David to rule my people Israel. My father David had it in his heart to build a temple for the name of the Lord, the God of Israel. But the Lord said to my father David, because it was in your heart to build a temple for my name, you did well to have this in your heart. Nevertheless, you are not the one to build the temple, but your son, your own flesh and blood, he is the one who will build the temple for my name. You see, God's name will be in the temple, not God. The name of the Lord signifies that the Lord will own the building. He will put his name to it. His presence in it is real, but he won't be confined to the building. I listen to these amazing words from the Apostle Paul. Over 700 years later, in Acts chapter 17. Be really good to turn there on page 783 in the Blue Church Bibles. Acts 17, verse 22. As Paul speaks to those living in Athens. Listen out especially for verse 24. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, people of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with this inscription, to an unknown God. So you are ignorant of the very things you worship. And this is what I'm going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. See, God is not going to live in hands built, he's not going to live in a temple built by human hands. Rather, it is he that gives everyone life and breath and everything. You see, we don't house God, God houses us. We can't make the mistake of thinking that God can be housed, controlled or domesticated. God is way, way bigger than that. Our prayers aren't us trying to twist God's arm or to give him advice. Our prayers should be us submitting to his authority in everything we say and ask. You see, God's glory and presence fills the temple according to his covenant. But God is not contained by the temple. And one day, God will dwell among his people. You see, I think Solomon got it wrong. Well, we know Solomon got it wrong in verse 13, didn't he? He said, I have built a magnificent temple for you, a place for you to dwell forever. You see, God's plan was never to dwell in the temple forever. His plan was far greater and way more amazing than that. But one day God is going to dwell among his people forever. Physically. It's the only way that we can fully be God's people in God's place, under God's rule, experiencing his blessing. Not afraid of his glory like the priests in the temple, but rejoicing in his glory because our sin has been dealt with and we feel no fear before him, because we'll have nothing to fear because our rebellion has been forgiven by God. We know this to be true because God lived among his people in the Garden of Eden. And he gave pictures of his real presence all the way through the Old Testament. The cloud, the ark, the covenant, the tabernacle, the temple, his word. And God has promised to be among his people. But God has dwelt among man, hasn't he? He has rubbed shoulders with his people. He has walked in the footsteps of man, so to speak. God became man, so man could dwell with God. Listen to these words from Philippians chapter 2. I'll just read it. In your relationships with one another, have the same mindset as Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself nothing by taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow, in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue acknowledge that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. And so Jesus comes to earth. Jesus steps out of heaven and comes to earth. Jesus is Emmanuel. Jesus is God with us. Jesus is God the Son, and he lived among us, and that he died for us so that we could live with God our Father. You see, God's not going to come down from heaven to live among us again. Rather, at the end of all earthly things, we are going to live with him. He will bring us to heaven. He will bring heaven to us. Revelation 21 verse 3, it'll come up on the screen. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look. Look, see it. There can be no mistake. God's dwelling is now among the people. And he will dwell with them. They will be his people. And God himself will be with them and be their God. You see, a time is coming when God will dwell with his people. Not symbolically, but physically. Of course, as Jesus promised before he returned to heaven, God is with us now in the Holy Spirit. We know it's true because what Jesus promised with his mouth, his hands do. He makes it happen. The Holy Spirit is really God with us, not symbolically, but spiritually. But a time is coming when God will dwell with his people, not just spiritually, not symbolically, but physically. We asked at the start whether God would dwell among his people. And the answer we've seen is yes, but he will only dwell among his people. The next obvious question then is this. Are you part of God's people?